This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn all about hearing loss and what can be done about it. Plus, we'll learn who's most at risk for gynecologic cancers and discuss the latest treatments. But first, a new surgical technique to treat kidney cancer. Well, in 2013, there were over 65,000 new cases of kidney cancer in the United States, with over 13,000 deaths reported from the disease. And the incidence seems to be on the rise. And here to tell us more about it and about a new surgical procedure to treat kidney cancer are Dr. Michael Dougherty. He's a urology resident at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Gennady Broslowski. He's professor and chair of urology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Dr. Broslowski, let's begin by helping us understand what we mean when we say kidney cancer.
Kidney cancer is traditionally known as a mixed group of tumors that is grown or that grows on the kidney. And just because it happens to occur on the kidney, these cancers may be very different in their sizes, their behavior, and their prognosis. So when I say mixed group of tumors, I refer to indeed these tumors that are referred to kidney tumors or kidney cancers, but they are all quite different.
So they're called kidney cancer because they occur on the kidney, but it could be different cell types, some are more aggressive, some...
That is exactly right. And some will respond better to one type of therapy versus others. Some will respond to better to one type of immuno or chemotherapy or something that we know that we refer now as TKI or a... tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which is a totally new type of drugs, while others will not. And it's very important that we understand and provide the expertise in treating those kidney cancers, knowing what the offender is and what it's made of.
Do you know what causes it? I mean, is there any clue as to why someone might develop kidney cancer?
Yeah, so the traditional causes for kidney cancer include hereditary disorders or disorders that have been passed on from parents to children through a defective gene. And in fact, there are several genes that are known to cause kidney cancers. And for those patients, we carefully monitor.
It does run in families.
Does run in families. There are some cancers where there are some kidney cancers where it does not run in families, and there are certain risk factors, smoking being the greatest risk factor. Of course, patients that are also at the high risk of developing kidney cancer are those that are overweight or obese, those that have high blood pressure or have been taking high blood pressure medications for a long time. So, but those are what is known as associations, meaning that if we do find kidney cancers, we often find that these patients are bigger and fatter and also have a high blood pressure.
So we don't necessarily see them as causal. You're saying that they basically co-occur.
They co-occur, but yet we do certainly know that if somebody smokes, it is so much more likely to co-occur.
How about things like age?
So it is true that we do find the kidney cancers in older population much more commonly than we find in younger people. Although we cannot truly say that age is a risk factor, once again, just because we find it in the older people, but we do have more opportunity for kidney cancers to develop in the older person
with
all the risk
factors,
the longer you live, like with most other type of cancers.
Dr. Dougherty, what are some of the symptoms? I mean, how would someone know that they had kidney cancer?
There's various symptoms that can show up for someone that might have kidney cancer. One being blood in your urine. This could be blood that you can't see. It could be the urine could be red in color, could be pink, could be cola colored. You can have back pain on just one side that tends to be below the ribs and does not go away.
So it's persistent back pain.
Yes, it's not like the normal back pain you wake up in the morning. It's just constantly there. It doesn't really get any better. You can have intermittent fevers, weight loss, fatigue. And oftentimes, tumors are identified not intentionally. It was when they had a CT scan or some other imaging done for another reason, they find a questionable area on the kidney.
So that's kind of worrisome, I would think, to our listeners in the sense that it's almost like a silent cancer and you might just find it inadvertently. Is that the case?
That is true. Unfortunately, when patients present with symptoms, the disease may be much more advanced. And that is why, as urologists and personally as a urologic oncologist, I remain diligent with the working up of these kidney tumors in patients that have episode of hematuria or blood in the urine. Whether or not patients even see it or they don't, known as microscopically, they are identified to have blood in the urine, this is extremely important for us to complete the workup for this.
So getting to that, in terms of diagnosis, how do you make that diagnosis? And is it important to be screening people?
For if there's a questionable possible lesion on the kidney, some area that is of concern, the way that they normally work it up is a CT with a renal mass protocol. So it's a CAT scan that has different phases that has been shown to be able to evaluate possible kidney tumors better. There's two phases. One is without any contrast, so it's a baseline CT scan. And then following, they give you IV contrast to see how the kidney lights up and how the possible tumor lights up. And depending on how well it enhances or how bright it gets is a way that they can essentially say this is most likely a tumor or not.
And they might then be called upon to do something further, perhaps take a tissue sample, a biopsy of some kind to determine?
Right. It depends on either where it's located, how it's looking, the patient's overall health, if they'd be able to undergo a surgery, if they want to get a tissue diagnosis first.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Michael Doherty and Dr. Gennady Bratslawski, and we're talking about kidney cancer. So just let me get this straight. The important thing here to remember is that if you have blood in your urine, even on a routine screening at your primary care doctor's office, that's a sign that needs to be followed up on.
That is true. The recommendations from American Urologic Society is to have it worked up. And what I mean to have it worked up is often done in a urologist's office. And here at Upstate, we see hundreds and thousands of patients with blood in the urine. And while in many, presence of blood in the urine turns to be completely benign, meaning not having a cancer, I certainly do not wish listeners to be fearful if they are told that they are found to have blood in the urine. But I do not want anyone to ignore a possibility that there may be some other causes other than benign causes for this blood in the urine, and therefore we recommend that these patients are seen by us.
I want to talk about treatments, though. It seems to me that obviously surgery is going to be a major treatment for dealing with it, but are there other medically interventions that you can do, less imposing interventions? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so indeed there are some less aggressive treatments other than the classic surgery that could be done. First of all, we at Upstate perform most of our kidney surgeries using laparoscopy or robotic assistance. So first of all, we are able to avoid major incisions.
It's minimally invasive.
It is minimally invasive, laparoscopic, and using robotic assistance as well. Now, other treatments that we have is cryoablation and radio frequency ablation. And what I mean by ablation is destroying of this tumor while the patient does not undergo pretty much any incision, and it is done by conjoint work with us and interventional radiologists who are able to place special probes straight into the heart of this tumor and either hit it to a degree where the tumor can no longer survive or freeze it to a point that, once again, the tumor is no longer viable. So we do have several non-invasive or less invasive treatment modalities. And, of course, active surveillance is also an important option for these patients because not everyone with a kidney tumor, even if we suspect it to be kidney cancer, must undergo or should absolutely be treated. Many of these tumors may be what is called as indolent or slow-growing or something that will not necessarily cause any harm to an individual's life. And we frequently practice it, especially in older patients or patients with many medical conditions or what we call them comorbidities, such as diabetes, heart problems, those on blood thinners. We do not necessarily need to be treating every patient. As I often say, the role of a surgeon is to find the reason not to operate rather than subject somebody to an unnecessary intervention.
Wow. Well, let's get to the surgery, though. So, because I think traditionally, obviously, when a tumor has been found, there is the move to try to remove that tumor in some way. And it's my understanding that at one time, the kind of standard operating procedure was what they called a radical nephrectomy, which is taking that entire kidney away. And since we have two, you can survive comfortably, it would seem, with just one kidney. But now there's been some movement toward what they call a partial nephrectomy, which is just removing the tumor itself. Tell us about that, Dr. Doherty. And you were just involved in some kind of a study taking a look at the efficacy of both of those procedures. Tell us about it.
That's right. So we just looked at, we analyzed patients from the SEER database. It's a nationally run database that's orchestrated by the National Cancer Institute. It covers approximately 28% of the entire country with all the tumors that are recorded. It has various regions throughout the country and different locations that input the data. We looked at young patients between the ages of 20 and 44 that underwent a surgery for a kidney tumor. They either could have had a radical nephrectomy or the partial nephrectomy where they cut out just the tumor itself. We looked at these younger patients because we wanted to see what effects the surgery itself would have on the patient in their long-term outcomes. So with the younger patients, they would assume to have less underlying diseases, less chance of having hypertension, heart disease.
Things that would confound your results, in other words, that would muddy the water of what your results were.
Right.
In terms of the surgeries themselves.
Right, things that would possibly cause them to have an earlier death than would be expected. So we looked at these younger patients that all had small localized tumors and we saw how they compared to each other in both overall and cancer-specific survival. We found that there was no difference in cancer-specific survival between the two groups, which means that, you know, from an oncologic outcome, from the tumor itself, there was no difference in the surgical removal got rid of the cancer in both ways equally. But in overall survival, so just how they did it in general, that those treated with a radical nephrectomy, where they took the entire kidney out, did worse at 10 years. Those that had the nephron-sparing surgery, they kept as much of the kidney as they could, they did better in the long term. They had a decreased chance of other outcomes.
That's quite significant. And also, is the recuperation from one better than the other also?
Well, technically, now that we do so many surgeries using minimally invasive approach, the recuperation tend to be quite similar. So we're trying to not offer a much more morbid or much more difficult operation with many more complications. Yet it is truly known that removing part of the kidney is more challenging than removing the entire kidney. And we often counsel the patients that while they may accept some shorter-term complications that are more likely to happen with the removal of the tumor only, we are trying to look for their longevity and long-term health risk.
And so this type of finding really supports just what you're saying, that it's a preferred method if you can achieve it.
Correct. While the literature still provides enough controversy whether or not the partial removal of the kidney, removing the tumor only, is better than the total removal, most of the literature still continues to point with the kidney preservation, and this is something that we're quite experienced here at Upstate. We have several urologic oncologists to do it, and we have recently published this paper in Journal of Urologic Oncology.
So what's the prognosis? I don't want to run out of time.
The prognosis of the cancer, of the kidney cancer, depends on the stage. These tiny localized or small localized tumors can be successfully treated, and the most patients will enjoy survival of greater than 95% chance. So having been diagnosed with kidney cancer does not necessarily mean a lethal diagnosis. Of course, as the tumor grows, becomes more advanced, or grows into nearby structures, vessels, or organs, of course, this decreases the chance for the long-term survival. Yet we do have many trips here at Upstate, such as immunotherapy and such as additional therapies using vaccine and part of the trial that we have here at Upstate as one of the few sites in the world where we truly feel that we could potentially improve the survival of these patients.
So basically, it's a sunny outlook, it sounds like, overall, for what you're, all the different options that exist for people with kidney cancer.
I completely agree. And it's very important that patients with kidney tumors are managed in a setting where they can be provided what is called a multidisciplinary approach, where they have radiologists, pathologists, medical oncologists, all unified, and where presence of a tumor board, for example, something that exists at Upstate, could allow them to truly get several expert opinions in one room prior to initiating the final treatment plan.
Well, it sounds very hopeful. I want to thank you both for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Michael Dougherty. He's a urology resident at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Gennady Broslawski. He's professor and chair of urology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again so much. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, hearing loss, its causes, and what can be done about it. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Our hearing is one of our most critical senses. It's essential for spoken language learning, for communication and social interaction, and even for survival. So if you take your ears for granted, please listen to this. Hearing loss is the third most common health problem in the United States, and it's on the rise. We'll hear with more on this as Dr. Brian Nicholas. He's an assistant professor of otolaryngology and communication sciences at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Nicholas. Thanks for coming.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So we shouldn't take our hearing for granted, obviously.
Right. Yeah.
It's crucial for life, right?
There's no question about that. You know, I think when you think about hearing loss in children, it's crucial for our speech and language development. I think, you know, there have been big studies looking at children who have hearing deficits and their own failure to develop speech and language at a way that's commensurate with other children their age.
And it affects their cognitive development. I mean, language
absolutely.
Is basically the symbolic system that we use to be able to think.
That's
and
right.
reason. And
that's right.
So it's really kind of the basis of the, it's the core for human communication. It's also the core way that with language that we communicate with others and have social relationships.
Absolutely, and we see that in the adult population. You know, you mentioned at the outset that hearing loss is increasing in incidence. And as the population sort of ages, hearing loss is on the rise. What we see in those adult populations tends to be isolation. Because communication tends to suffer.
It's interrupted.
Sure.
So let's make a distinction here between hearing loss in childhood. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things that cause it in childhood?
Well, there's lots of things that can cause hearing loss in child. And, one of the things that I hear a lot of from patients is this something that runs in our family? Is this something that's genetic? And when we think of childhood hearing loss, usually it's congenital, which all that means is they were born with it. It doesn't imply that it was hereditary, though it can be. If it's congenital, it can be either hereditary or acquired at the time of birth, for instance, from an infection either before or during or after birth. Usually that hearing loss is picked up. The state of New York, as do all states at this point, have newborn hearing screenings, and the state of New York was one of the first and remains one of the very best at doing that. Rarely is there an identifiable genetic cause of hearing loss, though there are a few tests that we can do that can elicit that.
But the truth is that, as you said earlier, and we've been saying, it is really such a powerful force in their lives that that requires all kinds of intervention, whether it be hearing aids and then early intervention with language development therapy and all that. But I wanted to focus today a bit more on the one that's so-called on the rise, maybe because the population is aging mm-hmm. and living longer, mm-hmm. and that's what we call the hearing loss of age. Is that also known as presbycusis?
That's right. Yeah, yeah, presbycusis, which is, just like you said, age-related hearing loss. And it is on the rise, probably because the demographics of our population has sort of shifted somewhat. It's exquisitely common, and one of the hallmarks of that audiometrically that we see on a hearing test or an audiogram is really high-frequency hearing loss. So the low frequencies seem to be okay, but as you get into the mid and high frequencies, the hearing trails off.
So certain types of sounds, I know things like S's and F's are produced in a high frequency way, and that prevents mm-hmm. people from understanding language. It becomes a little bit more muddled what they hear.
That's right, yeah. Our speech is made up of a whole series of vowels and consonants, and there are different frequency characteristics of each of those. One example I'll give you is somebody who might have high frequency hearing loss will not be able to tell the difference between the words while and wife and wise. What they'll hear is why. They're not hearing the back end of that because that tends to be slightly more high pitched than is the rest of the word.
I read somewhere that one out of three people aged 65 to 74 have some level of hearing loss. That's astounding.
Yeah, and I think that's a conservative estimate. I think it's probably more than that because of how unrecognized hearing loss tends to be, especially in older populations. We typically see it manifest mostly with isolation. And unfortunately, these are folks who, as they become more isolated, tend to be less likely to seek medical care and to have formal hearing tests. So yes, it is a big problem and one that's probably under-recognized.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Brian Nicholas, and we're talking about hearing loss in adults and what can be done about it. So I want to get back to this idea of, besides obviously the natural course of events, and they don't always understand as you age why you lose hearing. How about things like noise exposure? It seems that in this world today, there are so many things that are making noise yeah. all the time.
Yes. Mostly age-related hearing loss is due to a loss of hair cells within the organ of hearing, the cochlea. And in mammals, once those hair cells are lost, they don't come back. We know that in certain bird species, that's not true. And most of the research into hearing restoration is aimed at hair cell regeneration based on what we see in bird populations. But you mentioned noise, and noise tends to damage the hair cells in the same way that aging does. And if you were to look at an aged cochlea or organ of hearing and compare that to a young one that was exposed to high levels of noise, they would look nearly identical. Hair cell loss. Yeah.
Hair cell loss. So yeah. Hair cells are these little cells within the cochlea.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So the whole idea of people walking around with their earbuds blasting their iPods
yep.
is problematic.
So noise is a huge issue, and there's a great deal of research right now looking at safe levels of noise. Good studies were done in the 1970s and 1980s that were commissioned by OSHA, actually looking at safe levels of sound for workers. And generally speaking, 80 to 90 decibels and below is considered safe levels. As you go above 90 decibels, that's an unsafe amount of sound. And the louder you go, the less time it takes for your cochlea to be damaged.
So it's really important to be aware of that in your daily life, to try to avoid noise exposure much as possible.
There's no question. We see it either from gunfire. We see it from use of heavy machinery. We see it from loud music. And that's one that's specifically on the rise because of the popularity of personal listening devices, iPods and so forth, where people just constantly have earbuds in. unfortunately, the volume levels on some of these devices are not at safe levels.
They're not regulated in that way.
So, yeah. So there's the potential for significant noise-related hearing loss. And one thing we know is it tends to snowball. So for people who have damaged cochleas from noise, they tend to be ones that have even worse hearing as they age because there's an additive effect that goes along to the
cochlea. How about certain other illnesses that can cause hearing loss? What are some of the things that contribute?
Well, there are lots of different diseases that can lead to hearing loss, one of which is Meniere's disease, of course. Meniere's disease is primarily a disease of the inner ear, that is the cochlea, as well as the balance organs. There are canals, balance canals, very near the cochlea within the inner ear. And we think that there's probably some mixture of the fluids of the inner ear that leads to usually low-frequency hearing loss, but it can progress over time, and severe episodes of room-spinning vertigo. And that's really the hallmark
of the Meniere's.
Of Meniere's disease, that's
right. How about something like otosclerosis? I've heard that thrown around. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, otosclerosis is a different process than Meniere's disease. Many of these have sort of hallmark appearances on audiometry. So when a hearing professional, like an audiologist or an otologist like myself, looks at an audiogram, there are patterns of hearing loss that are characteristic of a certain disease process. For instance, I mentioned low-frequency hearing loss is very characteristic of Meniere's. Well, typically, that's inner ear-type hearing loss, and we can tell that on an audiogram. Otosclerosis is different in that we call that a conductive hearing loss. And again, we can tell that on a hearing test or an audiogram. Otosclerosis is basically a stiffening of one of the three bones of hearing that sit behind the eardrum. And what happens is that third bone usually tends to get a little stiff, and it doesn't conduct sound to the inner ear the way it once did.
Let's get to treatments, because mm-hmm. I really don't want to run out of time. Mm-hmm. What are the main treatments these days for hearing loss? I know we've had some pretty big breakthroughs. I mean, before we actually sat down here, you said mentioned cochlear implants. Mm-hmm. That's so exciting. Tell me about that.
Right. So as far as what we can do for hearing loss, it really does depend on the type of hearing loss and whether that's conductive hearing loss or whether that's an inner ear or sensory neural type hearing loss. Generally speaking, conductive hearing losses are ones that are correctable, either with procedures in the office or procedures in the operating room. Sensory neural hearing loss classically was described...
That's where the inner ear is
involved.
That's
exactly right, yeah. Was one that is not correctable. And those patients are often relegated to amplification devices.
Like a hearing aid.
Exactly, yep. Cochlear implantation is specifically designed for people who have severe or profound bilateral hearing loss.
Do they actually put a device within the ear?
Yep. So there are two components to a cochlear implantation. One of them is implanted at the time of surgery and goes into the cochlea, and the other sits outside on the skin, and you'd wear it like a hearing aid. But it's amazing technology and gives people who otherwise have no means of communication new ears, if you will.
Wow.
So it really is fantastic.
And that's being done pretty routinely these
exactly
days?
Exactly right. Yeah, we do that for patients who have age-related hearing loss, and we do it for little babies who are born without any hearing at all. So it really does run the gamut.
Wow. Yeah. That's really exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, in my old life, I was involved in this field, and nothing like that was available. So that's very, very exciting to
it
hear.
Is.
Very
yeah,
hopeful for these patients. I want to thank you so much for coming in with all this wonderful information. My guest has been Dr. Brian Nicholas. He's Assistant Professor of Otolaryngology and Communication Sciences at Upstate Medical University. And once again, hearing loss is on the rise, but there's hope out there. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Car wrecks happen in our community every day, from minor fender benders to major crashes that injure or kill people. So in our Expert Advice from the Experts at Upstate segment, emergency physician William Paolo explains what to do if you find yourself involved in a crash.
If you're in a car crash, there's a number of things you want to look for before you determine whether or not you need to call 911. The first thing that you wanted to say is, for the most part in a serious car accident, you want to stay in your car. If you, however, are in a car that looks like it's in imminent danger of being on fire or it's on fire, you want to step out of the car immediately. Some things that we look for that we really worry about for car wrecks and that we look for to quantify how bad your car accident was that you will look for as well. Number one, did your airbags deploy? If your airbags deployed, that was a high enough impact to sense that, and we may need to see you for the high impact. Number two, was there intrusion? What I mean by that was, did the car and the cabin around you collapse into you to the point that you needed even help coming out of the car? And number three, were you awake for the whole thing or did you lose consciousness? Number four, did you wear your seatbelt? If you didn't wear your seatbelt and you're finding yourself outside of your car, then you want to see an ambulance provider right away. Now, if you have kids in your car with you, people often ask, what do I do if I have children in my car? And then they're in their car seat. Number one, if they're in their car seat, keep them in their car seat. When EMS comes, they will transport them in their car seat to see us. And we much rather have them in their car seat, particularly when they're very little. If they're older or of toddler age, they may take them out of the car seat. They may put them in something to protect their cervical spine. But the most important thing is, we don't want you up and moving around if we don't know what your injuries are, because we worry about fractures to your neck. We worry that you may have injured something that may get worse by up and moving around. Now, after your airbag goes off, it may deploy this kind of chemical smelling thing, this white powder thing. That's not dangerous to you. You don't need to run out of your car from that. It's a benign reaction from the airbag deployment. What we worry about is that gets into your eye, then we'll worry, but it does not mean you need to run out of your car if that deploys. Certainly, we want you sitting in your car waiting for the paramedics to come rather than up and moving around. Now, some of the things we look out for, particularly if you have belly pain, particularly if you're one of those individuals that wears your seatbelt around your belly button rather than around your waist where you should, we're going to worry about injuries to your belly. If you have neck pain, either in the back of your neck, we'll worry about fractures. In the front of your neck, we're going to worry, if you didn't wear your seatbelt the right way across your clavicle, that it might have injured vessels in your neck itself. Now, if you have passengers with you or loved ones with you, if they're not up and moving around, if they're unconscious, or if they can't respond to you, then call 911 right away. And if you need to do a basic first aid, the first thing that you'll do is listen to see if they're breathing. Put your head and your chin really close to them so you can feel it. And if they are, you can then go ahead and call 911. If they're not, then you may need to learn some basic first aid. Just give them some rescue breaths and do some CPR if you can't feel their breathing or if you can't feel their pulse. But the most important thing of all of these is to stay in your car, especially if you're not in the middle of a highway or in a dangerous road. Even if you're in the middle of a highway, you don't want to get out. The more we find people get out, the more people get injured by oncoming cars. Wait for those people. Wait for the police officers. Wait for the medics to come to get you off the road, to seal off the scene with flares, and don't get out of your car unless your car is about to be on fire, and that's exceedingly rare.
Next, what are the risks for gynecologic cancers and the most up-to-date treatments? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for May 5th. Everyone loves bacon. How can you not love bacon? But eating large amounts of it has been linked to an increase in colon, rectal, and prostate cancers. Ditto on other meats like beef and hot dogs. Is this because we live in a bleak world governed by a wrathful demon? No, it's because every diet should rely on a lot of plant-based foods. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Gynecologic cancer. Well, it takes the lives of tens of thousands of women in this country each year. And here to tell us more about this is Dr. Rinki Agarwal, professor in gynecologic oncology in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome.
Linda, thank you for having me.
Now, this is the second time you're here, actually. The last time you were here, you did such a wonderful job of helping us understand all about gynecologic cancer. But there were some other things we wanted to talk about. We wanted to talk more about treatment and a little bit more about who is most at risk. So can you start out by helping us first, just a quick review, what are the types of gynecologic cancer?
Gynecologic cancers are cancers of the ovary, the uterus, cervix, vagina, vulva, and peritoneal cancers.
So mostly we're talking about, basically we're talking about cancers that take place in the anatomical structures of the woman's reproductive system.
That's correct.
Okay, that qualifies them as gynecologic cancers. And I remember the last time you explained to me that that there are differences in the cancer types that occur in these various cancers. For example, a vulvar cancer may be more like a skin cancer, whereas an ovarian cancer is what?
It's a cancer arising in the ovary that is related to ovulation. And a specific type of cancer. We call it a solid cancer. It's a solid tumor.
So the type of cell is going to be different, and therefore the treatment would be different than you might with a vulvar cancer, for example.
That's correct.
So let's talk a little bit about who is most at risk and why.
For ovary cancer, pretty much everybody's at risk, and it is an age-related phenomenon. The likelihood for a female to develop a cancer in her lifetime is about 1 in 70 or 1.5%. That is the general population risk, but it is at, there are certain people at increased risk. So a strong family history of ovarian cancer. So a first degree relative, a mom, a sister who has ovary cancer would put you at substantially higher risk, 2 to 3-fold over the general population. And if a strong family history also included other cancers, such as prostate in men, pancreatic cancers, or breast cancers more specifically, then we have now identified genetic predisposition, and people may have heard about the BRCA genes, also called as the BRCA genes, that confer these risks. There are other genetic things that also increase the risk of ovary cancers, such as Lynch syndrome and other genes that are of lesser effect, so their risk is not as significant as the BRCA gene, but overall contribute a fair amount, about 5 to 10% of all cancers of the ovary.
So let me get this straight. Are you saying that if your father had prostate cancer, you might be more at risk for ovarian cancer? You were alluding to male cancers as well.
I am, and it's anybody who has a significant cancer history in their family should probably have this looked at professionally and consider that there may be a genetic risk or a preponderance or an overrepresentation of cancer.
So if
it turns out, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
It turns out that prostate and breast cancers are fairly common in the population. So if you drew a family tree for anybody, they may have a breast or a prostate cancer. So in and of itself, just that one isolated cancer may or may not have significance, but it's worth asking the question. But if you had that and another cancer that kind of runs in this pattern of running in families in BRCA gene mutation carrier families, that's what I'm alluding to.
So is that true for the other types like cervical, uterine, vaginal, or vulvar as well? That they have
for
a strong
uterine,
genetic component?
Sorry, so uterine, yes, there is a preponderance. It can be related to colon cancers from a family history standpoint or with thyroid cancers. And again, if there is a overrepresentation of cancers in the family, especially for the more unusual types of cancers, it is worth asking the question.
So when you ask the question, I mean, what I need to understand is, so what does someone do? I mean, what are you basically recommending? If there is a preponderance of cancer in your family history, mm-hmm. whether on the male side or the female side, should you be tested genetically and at what point in your life?
I think that asking and having that be noted in your medical records so that a provider, the primary care person who's seeing you, it puts that on their radar screen. And then specifically asking them, this is not for female cancers alone, but in general, There is now more information available, and that seems to keep evolving every few years. It's worth asking, with this family history, am I at increased risk? Is there a screening that I should be doing for different body parts? For female cancers, it's the cancer, the genes that I've just alluded to.
But what type of screening is done at this point?
For ovary cancer, unfortunately, the screening isn't very good right now. It's not very robust. But what we do have are ultrasounds and blood tests that support the ultrasound. Really, besides those, it's the subtle findings, knowing, being aware of the findings that can suggest an ovary cancer, which are things like bloating, inability to eat, change in weight,
abdominal pain.
And those are all very subtle. They could happen to anybody for a myriad of reasons. But asking the question, being aware of the family history that sets you at increased risk, those are all things that people can preemptively do. Now, if you find that you have a predisposition and you ask the question, that may get you into a prevention discussion with your primary care provider. And that would be where the value mainly comes in doing this sort of screening.
And the prevention would include what?
So prevention in younger women can range from something like a birth control pill. There are chemo prevention, so drugs that can decrease the likelihood of ovary cancer. But really what's been tried and had the best success is removal of the ovaries when the time is right, from other social and family considerations for the patient. That's what causes the greatest reduction in risk.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Rinki Agarwal, and we're talking about gynecologic cancer, and specifically we've been talking about ovarian cancer. Now, I think that it's been a recent breakthrough where now they can harvest women's eggs and freeze them. Is that correct?
That's a great point, Linda. Thank you for that. So, yes, and that makes it possible for you to include the risk prevention that you want for your own health and still be able to have a family.
So in other words, you might be able to harvest your eggs mm-hmm. in advance of undergoing this prophylactic or preventive surgery and still then be able to, through other means, whether it's, you know, IUI or various other ways. No, not IUI. It would be...
That's correct. And there are numerous questions, and the technology is still in its evolutionary phase. So what we're talking about are freezing eggs or embryos. Freezing embryos, that technology has been around for several more years than freezing eggs has, and that has reasonable success. But if you weren't at the point where you could actually freeze an embryo...
Right, you didn't have a partner or a husband or what have you.
You're ready.
Already, and yet you felt like you were at a high risk, you could freeze your eggs.
Right, and that technology has evolved enough that we can now offer it. So you can have preservation of your ovary function in a fertility sense in the form of eggs, in the form of an embryo, and you could decide that you're going to get pregnant, and the fetus could be tested. Or you could say, well, I would like to become pregnant. You could go through an in vitro fertilization and pick an embryo that doesn't carry the same mutation if you knew the mutation you had.
Wow. We have come a long way there. I don't want to run out of time. Tell us about the interventions that are being done right now once you're diagnosed with something like uterine cancer or an ovarian cancer. What's being done to help people?
The mainstay or the initial step is to manage them surgically. And in uterine cancer specifically, but also in ovary cancer, at least in its early stages, that may be all that we need to do. The surgery has evolved greatly, and we're now offering minimally invasive surgery using laparoscopic surgery with the robotic platform to a vast majority of patients.
Help us understand, elucidate on that a bit. What does that exactly mean? What's happening? What's done?
So what we're doing is the same operation, so removal of the uterus and the ovary, but we're putting little incisions that are a centimeter or so in the abdomen, four or five of those, And then we put long instruments, and I have complete control if I'm doing the surgery. I have complete control of all the parts that are moving. I'm doing the surgery, and I have a robot that essentially is following my commands. It mimics 100% of what I am doing. I control every aspect of it.
So you might be sitting at a console a little bit away from the patient. The patient is on the operating table with small incisions with the robot actually following your commands and doing what's necessary.
Right. It's 100% mimicking of my actions.
What makes it, though, minimally invasive? Is it the fact that you're being guided by some kind of a visual, the endoscope or the laparoscope in this case, so that you see?
So the minimally invasive portion is the small incisions. And the technology, why we have adopted the robot, is because it has better optics. So I see things a lot better. It is able to mimic my hand motions because it has wrists that our old instruments used to not have. It's allowing me to do more complex surgeries in patients who have more complex histories or complex medical problems that wouldn't have been candidates for minimally invasive surgery. That's really where the value of this technology is that here would be a patient that I would not consider minimally invasive surgery normally. I would offer them open surgery, and they are now able to have the minimally invasive surgery, go home earlier, resume their life earlier, be that going back, you know, and taking care of things at home or work, be in less pain. And we have data now to say that it is an equal option to open surgery or laparoscopic surgery.
And as successful. The outcomes are the same.
Or the outcomes.
And the outcomes are even improved because of all the reasons you just elucidated. That you, there's less bleeding, the recovery time is less, people go home earlier.
We think of those as short-term outcomes. So in terms of the recovery and going on with their life or moving on to the next step, they're doing better. Whether or not it's actually affecting the long-term outcomes, their ability to have additional treatment if they merit that has not been looked at.
Where are we at right now with things with the chemotherapy side of things?
We have lots of options for chemotherapy. I have, in my previous discussion with you, alluded to the fact that it's, the cancers I deal with respond very well to treatment. One of the other things about it is also that there are lots of treatments available. And people can go through a long period of time and survive very well with treatment.
Okay, so basically there's been a lot of breakthroughs, clearly from the surgical intervention side, and we're always developing new drugs. Generally, are we improving the longevity of people who are diagnosed with gynecologic cancer then?
I think so. I sure hope to think that we're making a big difference. And this is an exciting time because there's been a lot of evolution in our understanding and our ability to help people.
Wonderful. Well, once again, thanks for coming back a second time. All your information is very, very important and very, very interesting. My guest has been Dr. Rinki Agarwal, Assistant Professor of Gynecologic Oncology in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, here's Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's award-winning literary and visual journal, The Healing Muse, with a selection about the healing value of laughter.
Thanks, Linda. Humor can be wonderfully healing. We've all heard of or known people who stock up on comedies while recuperating. Laughter can relieve our anxiety and help us cope. Poet Cherise Pollard teaches at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. She sent us a poem that recounts a conversation between the speaker and her ophthalmologist, and their exchange shows how therapeutic a good relationship between a physician and a patient can be. Here is the very funny poem, The Kidney, which she dedicates to her physician, Dr. Jamie Costello. Autoimmune diseases are like Italians, my doc says. You let one in, and before you know it, the whole damn family has piled in your house. I laugh a little, relieved that she doesn't ask me, do you ever wonder why me? Happy that she actually reviews my family history before my eye exam asks about my brother's lupus, mom's illness, my Graves' disease, and Bissett's. She looks over her eyeglass rims. So many serious illnesses. Did you guys live near a Superfund site? Seriously? The lights are out, and I am reading the smallest row as best I can. I tell her it's probably a little of both. Maybe I hit the genetic jackpot, or maybe I was exposed to something uncool at some point. Jersey and Long Island are toxic wastelands, we all know that, but who knows when or where. But it's more about lost family history than anything else. Old folks live with arthritis so long, bad hips and knees, gnarled hands and feet, they forget their original diagnoses. They make you crazy, family, that's for sure, she says as she wheels in to look at my corneas. But you have to remember the kidney. I put up with all that craziness just in case I might need one someday.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore one man's journey into stroke and out again, plus how breast cancer survivors can find support, and the problems with varicose veins and what can be done about them. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.